Recorded live in downtown Newtown, this is Rancho Notorious, a podcast about movies and other cool stuff. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious. Welcome, everybody, to the pilot episode of Rancho Notorious, the new podcast featuring people who may or may not have once contributed to another podcast once upon a time called Cinematica back in the day. My name is Dan Slevin, and here with me here in the Rancho Notorious studio, in Rancho Notorious itself, let's be honest, Kaylee Carruthers, welcome.
Hi.
And on the line from that Auckland, we have Darren Bevan, our guest host for this evening's show. G'day, Darren.
Hello, you're back. I'm very excited.
Yay.
And, here we are. We're only 40 minutes behind schedule, which, considering this has been a project 6 months in the making, I think we're doing pretty well, aren't we? It's a pleasure to have you all here. Let's assume that not everybody listening to the show listened to the other show that we used to do, so we'll perhaps explain a little bit about what Rancho Notorious is. It's a chat show, basically, featuring reviews and news and guests and talk about mostly movies, and movies that you see on the big screen, but also movies you see at home, movies you see streaming, movies you see on your iPhone when you're on the way to work.
And things created by home box office, which may or may not actually be on television.
Yeah, exactly. If it's basically narrative and it's on screens, it's grist to our mill. But our main focus is basically what's being released at the movies. And on this show, we're hoping to have guests from all over the world joining us via the internet. And we're also hoping to have lots of guests in studio to take advantage of the home comforts here at Rancho Notorious.
There's a beautiful chaise lounge for guests on the show, and I will be tweeting that image to, you know, woo people into the studio.
Yeah, and those of you that get to come to Rancho Notorious, either to witness a recording, because some of our fans...
That sounds really creepy.
No, it's like a studio audience of one. because we'll come to the Pledge Me campaign a little bit later on, but if you come to appear on the show, if you're a guest, then you get to have dinner with us afterwards, because here we are, we're in my house. And
We're not just going to record with you, we're going to...
And throw you out on the street.
No, we're going to romance you, feed you food.
Yeah. And wine. And so, Darren, next time you're in Wellington, make sure that you schedule some time to come and hang out with us in a way that's other than this electronically virtual one. It's a pleasure having you here.
I feel like it's pilot season, so I'm worrying that maybe I'll be the one that'll be recast after the studio's had a look at the novel. I might not make the set cut, so I think we'll have to lock down details of that dinner straight away, I think.
Okay.
Indeed. And we will be taking requests and food allergy information from you at the close of the show. In today's episode of the show, we are going to go to the edge of Tom Cruise over and over and over again. We test our tear ducts with the young adult romance, The Fault in Our Stars, and we remind ourselves how good the Kiwi escalator movie Fantail was. It played at the film festival last year, and on the previous show that we used to work on, we talked to the creative team and reviewed that film. It's now coming out at the movie, so we'll be talking about that a little bit later on. We'll also get an update from the Sydney Film Festival with our Australian correspondent Sam McCosh a little bit later on as well. But first, we should get a little bit of an update on how we're all doing. Sure. And firstly, you, Kaylee, it's been 6 months since we last gathered here on either side of microphones.
Yes.
What's going on in Kaylee Land?
Well, I am now working for the New Zealand International Film Festival. Gasp! Gasp! I know, exciting.
Tell us what's coming up. Oh, tell us now.
We're going to get to that a little bit later on, because there was a big announcement today, a very big announcement. It's very exciting.
I think when you say big announcement, you really mean a long announcement.
Long announcements.
I mean, it was big. It was exciting.
It was big.
World premieres, right?
But still, lots of world premieres.
Yeah.
Lots of world premieres. We will talk about that in a little bit.
Yep.
Because I'm working with the film festival in a lovely contract role this year, I will not be reviewing films for the first bit of the podcast Oh, sad. But I can't play favorites. Everything is great.
Yeah, it gets kind of political, basically, yes. Doesn't it? And we have this fantastic relationship with the film festival, and you know, there already I have seen my first film festival preview, saw my first one last night, and done my first interview for this show this afternoon. So, you know, we love the film festival, we love the people that they bring and the films that they bring, and so let's be honest, you know, perhaps some of our more hard-edged critical faculties do get put to one side when it comes to the film festival, let's be honest, but we, you know, it's a fantastic event.
Yes.
Darren, what have you been doing in the last 6 months?
Just slightly growing a bit of a beard. Feels like I haven't done as much as you guys. I've just been quietly pining away for you both.
Because the last time I saw you in person, I think, was at The World's End.
Oh, that was a long, long time ago.
It was.
Oh,
the memories.
Yeah, no, just been lurking and working, I think is the best way to describe it.
Oh, that's a good one.
All right.
That's a good hashtag.
For me, in the last few months, I've changed jobs a couple of times, and main reason why the show sort of went on, the old show, we'd give it a name because it had one, Cinematica, went on hiatus, really, was that I, you know, had to sort of focus on getting work and getting a new job. I'm now settled as the editor of Fishhead magazine in Wellington, which is the Wellington lifestyle magazine, and so I have had to take a crash course in things like recipes and fashion and beauty, which, you know, make up a large chunk of that.
Yeah, now I'm expecting big things for dinner.
Yeah, look, I'm busy here.
You do look very dapper today, I have to say.
So you're throwing in makeovers as well as dinner, are you?
Well, you know, who knows? If
I feel like I could use one.
If the opportunity presents itself, we would definitely be interested in doing that. But the problem that has been that I haven't been to the movies, really. I mean, I've seen a few things, but there was a time when I saw everything. Mm. I was right across the entire spectrum. And really, I feel like I'm Rip Van Winkle, and I'm just woken up after 20 years of sleep. And you guys are going to have to help me out with actually what's going on in the world, because this weekend that's just gone past is really my first sort of attempt to get back into it.
Well, I can't help you with films, but I can technically help you out a little bit with television.
Right.
And I do love my television.
Okay, well, we shall do a little bit of television in future episodes. Now, the reason why we're here at all, the reason why we can be here at all, is because we had the great support from a lot of people through a Pledge Me campaign. We crowdfunded the restart of, or rather the new start for this show, Rancho Notorious. And I think it's an opportune moment for us to thank those people. Some were anonymous, some chose to not be rewarded as part of their pledges, but the following names are people that we literally could not have done this show without. So, Kaylee, would you like to start?
Yes, I would. Steve Austin.
Sibylla.
Martin Roberts.
John Edwards.
Mike Riversdale.
Beth Brash.
Delia Shanley.
Tony Kennedy.
Shelley McMeekin.
Ken Sparks.
John Smythe.
Heather Clinton.
Savage.
Glenn Caulfield.
Kofi Montgomery.
Karen McCauley.
Simon Bennett.
Robert Cato.
Rebecca McMillan.
Steve Moore.
Aaron Alexander.
Random Films.
Chris Harmon.
Claire Queray.
Adam Goodall.
Murray Carruthers.
My dad. And Brenda Carruthers, my mom.
Yeah, well done. Mark Cuby.
Reese Pie.
Hey, hang on, my mum and dad aren't on this list. What happened there? Oh, no, hold on a second. Yeah, I did get birthday money, but they didn't pledge it. That's all. So they have done their bit. Parents all over have done their bit. So where were we up to? Reese Pie?
Yes.
Anthony S. Pratt.
Jeff Leland.
Miriam Ross.
Nicholas Finlay Ward.
Now, I'm not sure when people put their names into this thing whether they quite realised that we would be reading
butchering
their full,
them online.
Well, not just butchering, but reading their full names out. Anyway, so yeah, Nicholas Finlay Ward.
Anna Gunther.
Fred Thompson.
Chris Tease or Say. Chris, I don't know how to pronounce your last name, and I would really like to because we've been friends for a while. Sorry.
Matthew Buchanan.
Mike Dickerson.
Paul Johansson.
Daniel McClellan.
Andrew Cousins.
Sam McCosh.
Mark Ralston.
Alistair Ty Sampson.
Robin Gallagher.
And Annette Hutchins.
Thank you, all of you.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Some of those people are executive producers and will get additional added benefits throughout the season. So
that sounds really salacious.
Well, one of those extra benefits is a postcard from one of us in an exotic place. I know who's going to be sending postcards later on this year. Do you want to tell people what's going on?
Yeah, I do. Because if you are listening and you did listen to the other podcast, now I can step up and say that. Remember that time that I went to Telluride? Because I am going to Telluride this year for the film festival. I will be volunteering, and I got my volunteer position today, and I even get a printed staff pass.
Yeah.
With a really cool photo of me on it.
It's now my turn to be extremely envious, because I know what an awesome festival that is, what a great location it is, and we will insist that when you're not volunteering, you are in touch with us and telling us exactly what's going on there. So, yeah, it's fantastic. So, postcards from Telluride for everybody.
Straight from the Rockies.
Or the Sierras. Yeah. Anyway, we should get this show on the road, really. And even though it's a new start and it's a new show and a new name and a new brand, etc., yeah, some of the bits of the show are still pretty much the old show. So let's start off with what people have been watching with the New Zealand box office.
Right. So top five, starting at number five, A Million Ways to Die in the West, down from three. Number four, down from number one, X-Men Days of Future Past, holding it at number three, down from two, Maleficent, opening at two, Edge of Tomorrow, and in the number one position, with all those teens and their money, Fault in Our Stars.
Right. Now, we are very conscious of the fact that we have listeners all over the world, and we're not just a New Zealand podcast anymore. We are internationalists. We throw our arms around the world. So, is Australia doing anything very different to us in terms of box office?
They have How to Train Your Dragon 2 at number 5, and everything else is basically the same. So it's number at 4. It is different. It's been a long week. Number 4, X-Men Days of Future Past, and at 3, Maleficent, 2, Edge of Tomorrow, and 1, Fault in Our Stars.
All right, and in the United States, number 5, they pretty much got a lock on that number 5 position wherever you go. A Million Days to Die in the West, a film that has passed me by thus far. Darren, have you seen it? Yeah, I was going to say, is that one that I need to catch up on?
No, not really. It's probably one to avoid, I think.
Okay.
The fact that it's universally number 5 should tell you everything you need to know.
Number 4 in the US, X-Men Days of Future Past. I have seen that one and enjoyed it, but, you know, not nearly as much as the next film we're about to talk about. Edge of Tomorrow, Tom Cruise, number 3 in the US. Maleficent is number 2. And The Fault in Our Stars, which has already made something like 5 times the amount that it cost to make. Back in box office, that's the number one in the US. Meanwhile, in the UK, it's kind of it's ever so slightly different. Oh, number 5, A Million Ways to Die in the West. Number 4, Edge of Tomorrow. X-Men Days of Future Past, number 3. Number 2, Maleficent. And number 1 in the UK for the last weekend was 22 Jump Street.
Yeah! That opens today in New Zealand.
Yeah, and today in Australia as well, I think. So I'm not sure why the UK would have got it so much earlier than everybody else. I don't really know what the vagaries, the
intrigue.
Maybe
there's bigger Channing Tatum fans. Maybe they just like
they couldn't wait.
They couldn't wait.
They just couldn't. They were beating. They were breaking down the cinema doors.
Can you imagine what Magic Mike 2 is going to be like in the UK? Maybe we should go over there
and do a special trip, a Magic Mike 2. I think we should also go to Broadway to watch the Broadway musical version of Magic Mike.
Oh yeah.
I think it'll be fun.
Yep.
All right. So now it's time to get on to the main... So the reviews section of the show. He said, trying to get his bloody pieces of paper sorted out.
It's real, people. It's all real.
It is. And this is what we call a pilot, ladies and gentlemen. So this is where we iron out all of the kinks. So, Darren, are you ready to go?
Hell yeah.
I'm going to tell you a story. At first... It's gonna sound ridiculous, but the longer I talk...
We have to find the keys.
The more rational it's going to appear.
I can't believe you found coffee.
Sugar, right?
Yeah.
Hold on. 3. Like 3.
How many times have we been here? How many times?
For me, it's been an eternity.
I was all prepared to make some cheap jokes there about eternity and irrationalness, but actually the film was quite good. You know, it actually defies cheap jokes, doesn't it, really, Darren?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great, great, great blockbuster. A lot of fun. A real kind of popcorn film that really just entertains you from beginning to end. And Tom Cruise really impresses in it. I know there have been his detractors over his past few films, and Oblivion, his last one, wasn't perhaps his most popular one. But I think this one really brings the star wattage power of Tom Cruise back to the cinema, really.
Now, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about the premise of this film. It's based on a novel, isn't it?
Yeah, it's based on this Japanese novel, All You Need Is Kill, which I think was the original title.
They
got a bit nervous about releasing it under that at the box office, so it became the sort of more generic Edge of Tomorrow kind of title. I think that was decided by a committee somewhere down the line.
It certainly does seem a very big cop-out, but, you know, $200 million at stake, I understand.
Yeah, and basically the plot's about the Earth being invaded by creatures who are known as the Mimics, and with nations toppling around them, Tom Cruise's spin doctor, a guy called Major William Cage, finds himself thrust onto the front line by this vindictive general played by Brendan Gleeson on the eve of this major last push from UK soil to repel these aliens. He's completely out of his depth. I mean, this is a guy who spent his career working behind a desk, pushing the pencils, and basically being a bit cowardly and a bit snivelly, which I think is what qualifies you as a spin doctor, from my understanding of this.
I thought it was extremely, extremely cynical about the very, very important role that advertising plays in the modern world.
Yeah, there's like a lot of promotional video feel to it at the start, and I think it was also part of that in RoboCop, the remake recently of that Samuel L. Jackson's character, that talk show host sort of channeled a lot of that. So there was a lot of that kind of feel of it, and then it really steps up for this major Tom Cruise's character when he's thrust into the fighting and finds himself on the Normandy-style beach landing, and it was released, I think, in the States on the 70th anniversary of the D-Day landing, so it seems to be rather coincidence. But the big kicker with this is that he's killed pretty much quite quickly and then wakes up to find that he's jumped back in time and's got to do it all over again as he tries to work out exactly what's going on. And I think it was that kind of premise that really, really intrigued me. I was treated to 20 minutes of footage of the film a couple of months back, which was introduced by Tom Cruise himself, really kind of giving it his push. And I think it was just...
Did you get to meet him?
No, it was a pre-recorded bit that he'd done before footage in the cinema. So unfortunately, right. I'm not that well known yet. So I didn't happen to do that. But it was a very nicely presented piece. He was clearly passionate about the project, passionate about working with the director, Doug Liman, and very, very complimentary about Emily Blunt, who stars as basically the foil to character in this. And he gave this kind of impassioned speech about it all, why he wanted to do it and why he believed in it. And then they played the footage, and you're just like, I'm on board with this right from the start. I've seen bits of it before. It's got, you know, Starship Troopers, Groundhog Day, Saving Private Ryan, Looper, Elysium. There's not anything original on that front, but it was just very, very well put together and just very funny as well. There was humour with Cruise's character being offed in so many ways. I mean, if you're not a Tom Cruise fan and you've always wanted to see him die, this is the film for you, I think, really.
Groundhog Day is the film that most obviously comes to mind. It is effectively the same film, isn't it? Because you're talking about somebody who starts off as being, frankly, a bit of a dick, and who has to relive the same day over and over again until he learns to be a little bit less of a dick. And, you know, I'm amazed, frankly, that considerable amounts of money haven't changed hands between the various producers of this, because, you know, it's basically Groundhog Day in space.
It's very much like a video game now as well. I mean, if you're much of a gamer, a little bit of that I am, you know that it's about learning the rules of the game, applying that, and then just moving yourself a bit forward into it. So Tom Cruise's character starts off, he's killed more or less right away because he's not sure what he's doing, can't operate his gun. So the next time he comes back, he operates his gun, he knows how to do it, he tries to save some people, then he gets killed again. And it's that kind of repetition that really kind of gives it the analogy of the gaming world, and just it's more that, I think, than Groundhog Day, anything else, to be honest.
Sure.
Really,
I totally get the video game analogy and why it's so reflective of the video game experience. And I kind of surprised myself because I'm not a gamer, and I've never had the patience to have more than like two goes at anything. You know, like you die and it's like, well, why would I want to do that again? I'm just going to die again. Like there's no, I, something about the way my brain is wired, there's no challenge. Well, there is a challenge, obviously, and I just can't be bothered trying to face up to it. But you do enjoy playing games, right? And this is, you saw yourself, I mean, obviously in the Tom Cruise character.
Yes, I am, of course, you know, fabulously wealthy and in charge of Scientology and all of that sort of stuff. No, I think there is just a little bit of that kind of mentality of it that really kind of appealed to me with it. It was just the way that it was sold, and it was just a clever premise. And I think with the war stuff, it is like a war game on that front. It's very much like the first person shooter kind of stuff, and it just was. That kind of side of it struck a bit of a chord with me that perhaps I didn't first realize as I was in it, and gradually kind of realized that the more into the narrative you get, the more into the game of this of The Edge of Tomorrow you actually get as well. And I'm really quite surprised there isn't even a game version of it out there as a sort of video game tie-in, to be frank with you.
Let's talk about Scientology for a moment, because let's be fair, you know, a film about a guy who gets to restart his life every morning until he gets it right, you know, to fix the mistakes of the past. That's, you know, not, there's some philosophical, and should I say spiritual, analogies there or parallels with the Scientology. I mean, is this another film that's basically a Scientology advert under another name?
I don't think so. I didn't really get much of that vibe from itself. I was just kind of carried away by the popcorn nature of it and the fun nature. I didn't really take a religious message from it or a Scientology message for it or anything like that. I just went along with the vibe of it. And I don't think this is another Tom Cruise fronted assault against you to try and get you to his way of thinking. It's just a chance for him to actually show that when the big action comes to it, he's got it. And, you know, he may be pushing, what, I think in his 50s now. Mm-hmm. He can still carry a film. He can still open a film to a degree, although it's been rather eclipsed by The Fault in Its Stars Everywhere, as we've just heard from the box office stuff.
Big in
but
China.
I think as he's getting older, he's changing. He used to be the guy that would flash the million-dollar-watt smile, the teeth. And this, and in Oblivion particularly, he's kind of become a bit more determined. There's a moment in the film when he starts becoming a bit more determined, a bit more gritty. And I think that's the Tom Cruise we're getting now, rather than the one that's always been in your face and has been so... love him or hate him, Marmite feel to him that's polarized people before. It's just a box office treat. It's not perfect. There are faults in it, like there are with a lot of these sci-fi films. I don't get why Brandon Gleeson's character was so adamant that he gets shipped down to the fighting. I thought there was a part of that that felt underwritten. And the ending of the film itself, the final set of sequences, just felt very, very generic compared with the originality and humour and the action that had gone all before.
I'd be interested to know whether that ending diverges at all from the original, from the book. And I got the impression that it was a brilliant premise, but just that actually solving those problems turned out to be just a little bit beyond the screenwriters. But I don't want to criticize them too much because they got so much right. And the other thing that really impressed me about the film, and that's sort of to do with the marketing and scheduling of it, really, and that is the releasing it on the anniversary of D-Day, the 70th anniversary of D-Day. And, you know, the assault, I mean, it is so reminiscent of D-Day, the assault on the Normandy beaches, the attempt to rid Europe of this invading force. And you know, it couldn't possibly have been an accident that they decided to release the film on this particular weekend all around the world, and yet no one sort of mentioned it. No one made a really big thing of it. It was just like, you know, yeah, we are that clever.
I think it was released a little bit earlier in the UK though, wasn't it? It didn't hit the same time that it hit everywhere else, but maybe it's the perverse American feel that this time around they really did win the war for us or something like that. I'm not quite sure.
Or not, because they lose it over and over and over again. Maybe that's something to do with that. Now, we're coming to the end of this review, and you know, there's a lot about this show that is very similar to shows that, the previous show that we did, and but I'm just wondering, you know, and I'm going to throw this out to the audience listening, is like, we used to have a signature sort of sign off whenever we'd finished a review, and that was the two word review, and I'm thinking that it's time for something new. Mm-hmm. Unless you're all kind of in love with the old way we did it, and if that's the case, let us know, and we will, you know, bring it back. But I think we should just see what people think about whether we need a signature sign off, you know, like two thumbs up or two word review or
how many
whatever.
Horseshoes.
You know, and so we'll just leave things there, I guess. But you know, it just feels like we should have something. A little roundup thing, and I'm happy for it to be the two word review, apart from the fact that I was just complete crap at them, you know.
I've just totally sold myself on horseshoes.
I thought the whole fun of it was that you were completely crap in it, and we were just desperate to see what you'd come up with week by week. Even though you knew what was in the show, you were still struggling.
I know, exactly. I was the one that actually prepared all of the material for the show, and yet, you know, they would look at me across the table, and I would be completely lost. I would, you know, hyphenating madly. Anyway, if that's the case, I'm fully prepared to reinstate it. But let's see what the audience, you know, our wonderful pledges and our new audience think. So let us know. Do you want the two-word review, or have you got a better idea, basically?
And how are they going to let us know about these things, Dan?
Well, we'll stay listening to the end of the show, and we will let people know how to get in touch with us and where they can find episodes of the show, etc., etc., etc. I've decided that we're not going to do Facebook. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, just like...
Too much work.
Yeah, way too much work.
And Facebook pages keep changing and... Ugh.
And the rules keep changing and nobody can see your posts and all that sort of stuff. So we're just going to flag Facebook. It's going to be a website and Twitter and Letterboxd is basically going to be how you get in touch with us. All right, so time to look across the Tasman from our point of view at our correspondent from Australia. Sam Akosh has been going to a lot of movies at the Sydney Film Festival, so I spoke to her yesterday. Joining us now at Rancho Notorious, it's Sam Akosh, our Sydney correspondent. Sam, welcome.
It's very exciting to be here and to be talking to you again. Welcome to your new home.
Yeah, indeed, it's a wonderful, cozy new home we have here. Now, I feel like I've been asleep for the last 6 months, and I don't really know what's going on. So I'm going to ask you to help me out by telling me what's happening at the Sydney Film Festival.
Well, I'll start with what I saw last night because it's the highlight so far, and it's at the halfway point. So that's gives me the motivation for the next half, and that is Xavier Dolan, the French Canadian director, Wonder Kid, really, new film Mummy, which was the jury prize winner at the recent Cannes Film Festival.
And what was so unusual about it, or so effective about it for you, from your point of view?
This is an incredible story about this woman who's a solo mother. She's got a really troubled young son, sort of young teenager, and he's been in a facility getting some help, and he comes back to live with her, and it's sort of about their relationship and the relationship that they have with their neighbour, who's an ex-teacher who helps out a bit. It's just something so incredibly moving and emotional about it. The performances are phenomenal, and the ratio shot, and I'm not sure the exact tech specs of it, but it looks like it's been shot almost the same ratio as like what an Instagram photo would be, or a cell phone. It's very narrow, square ratio. It's a very interesting, very different looking film.
Now, Xavier Dolan, that's a name that I guess not many of us will be all that familiar with. What would we know about his work in the past? He's a bit of an enfant terrible, I understand.
Yes, he's a very young, I think he's only about 26 now, and this is his first feature, his first time in competition at Cannes. He last year put out Tom at the Farm, which was a very different turn for him. I also saw that at the festival. It's a bit of a psychological thriller, and previous to that, Lawrence Anyways, which did the rounds at quite a few of the French film festivals, so New Zealand audience may have had a chance of seeing that. So just very stylish, interesting filmmaker, very young, and I think just not afraid of trying different things.
So what have your other highlights been?
Would be Richard Linklater's Boyhood, which is filmed over 12 years, real time, telling the story, fictional story, of a young boy growing up from age 7 through to college.
Wow, and I have heard a great many things about that. In fact, I think I was made aware of it sort of through the rumours of it, about its making over the last few years. I wonder what it's like when you make a film like that to decide, you know, that it's finished. You know, surely the temptation will be to just keep on going.
I mean, I would quite happily watch adulthood if he made it, but I just don't understand how they got away with making this film over 12 years, just incognito, because you've got Ethan Hawke in there and Patricia Arquette, so it's not just complete unknowns, and yet he managed to keep it completely under the radar and give us this truly unique cinematic experience when you're watching a real person, although in a fictional narrative, grow up right in front of your eyes. It was quite extraordinary.
Is there anything exciting happening in terms of the Australian films, the Australian content?
Yeah, we had over the weekend the Australian premiere of The Rover, which is a follow-up to, what's the name of the film?
Is that Michaud's film?
Yeah, Michaud's follow-up. Animal Kingdom, that's right. And we had Michaud, Guy Pearce, and for all the fangirls, Robert Pattinson was in town. So,
golly.
That was quite a big deal.
I'm surprised that the Earth didn't twist around on its axis.
Well, the Robert Pattinson fans did hijack the Sydney Film Fest Twitter hashtag, so it was pretty unusable for 2 days with just love hearts and pictures of Robert Pattinson in pink tone.
Did you get to see that screening?
I did not. It's actually coming out in general release this Thursday in Australia. So
oh,
I'm going
it's
to
one of those.
Check it out.
Right, so
yeah.
It's just like a sneak, really. So, yeah, well, no doubt we'll be talking to you a little bit more closer. Well, once you've seen that film, because I loved Animal Kingdom, and I think the Michaud has got real talent. So, yeah, very keen to see what he comes up with next.
Yes, me too. I'm really, really looking forward to it. And the reviews have been very positive of it, so I'm quite excited to see that one. I'm checking it out on Friday.
Tell me a little bit about the vibe at the Sydney Film Festival. Is it are all the screenings in a sort of precinct? Do you walk from screening to screening, or is it spread out across the city?
So it's pretty much all in the central city. We've got the State Theatre, which is the sort of the main cinema where they have all the premieres and the competition films. And then there's a couple of other cinemas that are within sort of 10 to 15 minute walk. And they do have one of our historic cinemas across the bridge on the north side of the city where they have also screenings. So it's a really good vibe. They have a festival hub as well with talks by the directors and bar and like a film little store selling records and film-related books and things. So, it's a real great atmosphere.
Fantastic. What are you going to see tonight? I know that you've got like 3 or 4 minutes before you have to go and catch your public transport.
I'm going to see Black Hole Thin Ice, which is actually the winner of the Golden Bear at Berlin this year. It's a Chinese murder mystery thriller, so sounds like something to really wake me up after my day at work.
How many more days of the festival do you still have to go?
So there's still 5 days to go, and I've got, I think, another 14 films to see. So
oh,
it's going to be a...
Look, then I won't hold you up anymore, because the last thing I would want you to do is make you late for a screening, particularly at festival time. Sam McCosh, thanks very much for visiting with us at Rancho Notorious. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Dan. Lovely to chat.
That was our Sydney correspondent, Sam McCosh, at the Sydney Film Festival, which runs until Sunday. It's time for the news.
Yeah. News intro.
And you have, hot from the New Zealand International Film Festival press, the latest announcement. So what have we got?
I do. So today, Thursday, there were 13 New Zealand titles released today for the New Zealand International Film Festival 2014. The big news, there's lots of big news in there. Let's start with the big news. The Dark Horse is going to be opening in Auckland and Wellington.
And so, and do we know, is it going to be Auckland first? So the world premiere will be Auckland?
Yes, it's going to be opening Auckland first, which is the first... the first bit of the festival, and so it will be a world premiere for Auckland, following with the opening of the Wellington leg of the festival.
All right, and so tell us a little bit about what The Dark Horse is.
I'm so not ready. Directed by James Napier Robertson, it's a new New Zealand film starring Cliff Curtis as the late Genesis Potini, based on his story, the speed chess champion who passed on his gift to countless East Coast children.
Cliff Curtis, a fantastic New Zealand actor, and the first time he will have appeared in a New Zealand film since 2007, I think. First time he's been back here. So yeah, very much looking forward to seeing that, and I heard lots of amazing things about the production as well.
Yes, it just looks so beautiful. Can't wait to see the whole film. I've only seen the trailer. Continuing on, we have the other big announcement is the New Zealand International Film Festival will also be playing Housebound, which took South by Southwest by storm and is a New Zealand Kiwi horror comedy. And Ant Timpson, as many people know, is an executive producer on the film.
Right. And I think that's outstanding news. And, horror is, as Ant knows full well, you know, it's not always easy to get those films released in New Zealand. So getting those around the country through the New Zealand International Film Festival, definitely a very, very big deal. What are the documentary highlights? Is there anything there?
Oh, there's so many. Should I just read them all out?
Yeah, why not?
Sure. So we, by Gerard Smith. Is it Gerard Smith or Gerard Smythe? Gerard Smith?
Smythe, I think.
Smythe? Okay. We have Auntie and the Star People. Cap Bocage by Jim Marbrook. Mm-hmm. Erwan by Gavin Hipkins. And if you go to the New Zealand Film Festival website, which I highly recommend, you can see all the beautiful stills on the new website, and they're nice and big and beautiful. Everything We Loved, which was announced last week, a little bit quietly, because there's going to be a very exciting release pattern for that one, which you can read more about it on the festival website. Hot Air by Alistair Barry.
And I interviewed Al Barry for Fishhead magazine, the July issue of Fishhead magazine, so there'll be an article on Hot Air in that. And I'm fully expecting that we will be able to get him on the show before the festival is over, so he'll be on the couch, no doubt.
Also co-directed by Abby King-Jones. Voices of the Land, Larea Otofenua by Paul Wolfram. Notes to Eternity by Sarah Cordery, which looks really exciting. Orphans and Kingdoms, which will be a world premiere, and that's Auckland only.
I'm very keen to see that, actually. Oh, Auckland only, did you just say? Oh, I'll have to go up to see it. Because in my previous job as editor of On Film Magazine, I spent a day on set for that particular film. So I'm very keen to see how that turns out.
Yes, Reality by Jonathan King.
Oh, yes, very exciting. Anybody on Twitter who's been following Jonathan will know that, that's a very exciting project and, a self-funded project. And, really interesting idea. Great to see that executed and see that ready to go.
Te Awa Tupua, Voices from the River by Parawa Joseph, and Tumanako Hope by Susie Poynton. Tumanako Hope will also be Auckland exclusive, as far as I know.
Yeah, at the moment. At the moment. Yeah, that's the thing, is that scheduling's just begun, hasn't it, just this week for Auckland, and so, things could still change, It's not until the actual program gets into your actual hands that you...
But even then, there's so many surprises. It's just, it's just great. It's just always great. All the time.
All right.
This time of year is the best time of the year for the film festival, when you wait to hear what's coming. You've got expectations. You've got hopes. You're just really keen to know. You're talking to people who might know, and you're trying to get stuff out of them, and they're refusing. But I just think it's the anticipation and the announcements that are coming out each week just fueling the excitement. It seems like it's going to be a really vintage big year for the festival.
Exactly. Certainly 13 Kiwi titles is just absolutely outstanding. But you're right, this is the best time of the year because at this point you haven't had to choose between films clashing.
You know, that's the worst.
Exactly. At the moment, everything is still possible.
Yes.
Except everything. For opening weekend for me, because I know I have to go to my sister-in-law's wedding down in the South Island, so I will be missing the opening weekend, which I am devastated about, but also very happy for my sister-in-law.
Oh, yeah, and so you should.
Are you going to hold that over her for the rest of...
It seems petty, but probably yes.
Right, so moving on.
To international news.
International news, yes. Dan, you take this one. I feel this might be a little bit scandalous from your
account. Look, I don't know. Look, Italy's equivalent of the Oscars, the David Di Donatello Awards, were recently criticised as a farce by Italian filmmakers due to the fact that the jury has been described as bloated because it has over 1,700 people on it. Basically, if you, you know, it's like Friends and Favours and, yeah, you can be on the jury and, yeah, and it's grown to 1,700 people and nobody knows what the heck is going on. The only times that anybody, I think, in New Zealand ever pays any attention to the David Di Donatello Awards, because they never get mentioned in the film festival program, even though I'm sure they're, you know, high-profile Italian films. But it's not one of those things that gets cited. But the Italian Film Festival mentions it a lot. You know, it's always, this one, 17 David Di Donatello Awards.
Ooh.
So just so you know, it would appear to be as much of a dog's breakfast as the Golden Globes.
And a recent study has proved that films about females make more money and are probably funnier than films about men. Okay, what's written here on the news, which Dan wrote and he's giggling about like he's sex, is females make more money than films about people with doodles. A look at the 100 highest earning movies of 2013 reveals that movies with a female protagonist earn 20% more on average than movies with a male protagonist. The numbers break down to $116 million on average for female-led movies and $97 million on average for male-led ones.
And
that's what I'm talking about.
Sure. Now, what that fails to take into account is The Hunger Games. And, you know, because The Hunger Games was so much bigger, so much bigger. But I think, I mean...
Fault in Our Stars?
Well, exactly. I think,
which would be this year.
And I'm sure the Hollywood studios will find a way of discounting it and saying it's a one-off, it's not a trend, et cetera, et cetera. But, yeah, pretty hard to argue with the raw numbers there.
Mm.
Talking of the fault in our stars, maybe it's time we talked about it.
I believe we have a choice in this world about how to tell sad stories. On the one hand, you can sugarcoat it. And nothing is too messed up that can't be fixed with the Peter Gabriel song. I like that version as much as the next girl does. It's just not the truth. This is the truth.
Hey, make some friends.
Some samples there from the very, very up-to-date and hip soundtrack for The Fault in Our Stars. And this is a film that I got to see. I actually, you know, went to see three films this weekend and I'm feeling like I'm getting back into the swing of things. Tuesday night, big house, big audience, cheap Tuesday at the multiplex. And I think it'd be fair to say that my companion and I were the only people in the entire cinema with dry eyes at the end of that particular film. It seemed to be the kind of film that was determined to wring a tear out of you at all costs, you know. And yet, I looked over at my companion afterwards and said, "You crying?" She said, "No, good." As the credits rolled, I'm afraid I just was really unmoved by this. And, you know, I cry at almost anything at the movies, you know. Like, I'm a real soft touch. It doesn't take much to wring an emotion out of me. Darren, were you a sobbing mess on the floor of the cinema, or were you as unmoved as I was?
Relatively unmoved, but I wonder if that is a case of being a little bit older, maybe a bit more cynical and a bit more worldly wise. I mean, I don't know what the makeup of the audience was that you saw the film with. When I saw it at a preview, it was predominantly teenage girls, to be brutally honest. And and one friend who'd got dragged along hadn't been told what the film was, and his reaction when he realized what was going on was utterly priceless. That was just brilliant. But I think that is the power of these films. They talk to an audience, they speak to an audience that are passionate about the first love aspect, or they're passionate about the story because it delivers all the feels, as they say in the vernacular these days. And I think that's why it was so powerful. But I think if you're a bit older, and maybe I think potentially because we've seen a lot of films of a similar ilk in some ways, we've seen a lot of these kind of literature films like Twilight and The Host and
all
of those.
Well, that's a big stretch calling Twilight literature.
Well, I said literature and Twilight. I suppose, but we've seen films of that ilk before, so it's really a case of maybe with those films that they're ticking boxes that perhaps we've already ticked off and moved on. But I thought this one moved a little better. It didn't wallow like these kind of films tend to, given that it's a film about, you know, teenagers with cancer. This is potentially kryptonite material to many who are prone to, you know, crying tears over this kind of sick-lit novel genre. But I thought it was just well done. It had a wit and it had a worldliness about it and a humour that stopped it from the wallowing, stopped it from the mawkishness, and stopped it from really making you feel like this was, oh my God, another of those films. And I thought that's why it kind of worked for me, I have to say. But yeah, did it reduce me to tears? No. But did I feel like I wanted to throttle someone halfway through it? No. So that's probably a good thing, right?
I think it has come to this, that not wanting to throttle somebody in the movies is, you know, almost is, it's an extra half a star, isn't it? No, carry on.
I just think it just worked. I mean, Shailene Woodley was good in it, and, you know, maybe the lead guy, Ansel Elgort, strangest name I've ever heard, as Augustus, the love interest, he was a little bit bland and a little bit wishy-washy. But I thought
if he gets to make another film, then something's gone seriously wrong, I reckon.
Well, they were brother and sister in Divergent, weren't they? So clearly they've got history. Although how you go from brother and sister to being, you know, potential love interest seems a little bit weird to me. But
yeah, I'm sure there were a lot of Divergent fans in the audience going, ooh, at one point.
Yeah, and it doesn't stray from the lines. I mean, I remember writing a couple of them down, when one of them was, it would be a privilege to have my heart broken by you. And those are things that, you know, you can't really say in a screen. You don't say that in life. I've never said that in life when I've been going out with anyone or dating someone. You just get slapped across the face and told to jog on, quite frankly. But, I mean, you can get away with those on the screen if it's in the right setting. You couldn't get away with that in Twilight because you were just rolling your eyes. With this, it kind of worked, and I thought that was quite a remarkable touch, and that's probably why it's been so phenomenally popular worldwide, because the power of the teen reader and the people who love that kind of young adult is all present.
Well, this is what's interesting, I think, about this whole business, is that there's a huge audience out there who... whose experience of life is not particularly thorough or rich as yet, you know, and so the first love is just absolutely overwhelming, and the first breakup is absolutely devastating, and the you know, when you're that age, you look at literature and you look at films as a way to help guide you through life, and you think that everything is much, much more important and much more profound than, you know, it actually is, until you know, as you get older, you realize that everything's there's nuances in life that the film didn't seem to really sort of pay much attention to. There were two scenes in it that I thought really had the potential to be kind of interesting, and then the film sort of started them and then walked away from them, and they were both involving older characters, like when they go and visit the author, played by Willem Dafoe, in Amsterdam, and he starts saying some pretty intense, interesting stuff, but none of it gets interrogated. The kids, presumably as stand-ins for the kids watching the film, the kids in the room just went, I don't want to hear you. I'm not interested in what you might know about the world, having lived in it for twice as long as us, because your experience is less important than our potential. experience, you know, and that's what the filmmakers did. It basically sort of chopped them off at the knees. And the same thing with the parents. You know, there was a really interesting scene with the parents where they find Shailene Woodley's character says, I hate the idea of you not being able to go on without me. And then she has to face up to the fact that actually they've been talking about just that in the kitchen before she came downstairs, you know. And but that was interesting, you know, that I mean, this is what the self-obsession of young people and the natural sort of narcissistic self-obsession of young people is all about. You don't realize that actually you're not the center of everybody else's universe. But I think that the film sort of hinted at it and then went, you know what, that's actually too difficult for the audience and for this particular story.
Yeah, but I think there were parts of that. I mean, Hazel Grace, as you heard from that clip that we just played, she's very, oh, life's going to be solved by a Peter Gabriel song, and here it is. And then she's like, well, actually, that's not how it happens. And I think that side of it was a little bit unique. We've not really seen any characters like that, and I've certainly never seen a character on screen who spends the whole time strapped to an oxygen tank and with a tube in her nose. It's just that side of it, I thought, really, really stood out as something a bit different from it. And yes, it's all formulaic at the end of the day. Yes, the ending is incredibly weepy, and it's aimed to devastate as it takes, you know, aim at people's hearts of the youngsters as they see it being put together. But I think it just kind of worked, and I'm at a loss to explain to it because, you know, when the invite came in and the chance to go and see this came up, I thought, I know exactly what this is going to be like. There's going to be humor, there's going to be pathos, there's going to be tragedy, there's going to be terrible lines, there's going to be everything you expect in a stereotype. But it threw a few curveballs here and there that I really appreciated, and didn't make those 2 hours and however many minutes where it was seem as bad as potentially it could have been.
You know, funerals aren't really for the dead people, there are they? Though they're for the living, actually. I thought that was a really profound little insight 3/4 of the way through the film that nobody else had ever had before. Look, I shouldn't be so mean about it. I shouldn't be so mean about young people, really, because, you know, the children are our future. Teach them well. And anyway, my final point about, or my final question really about the Fault in Our Stars is, why isn't Shailene Woodley Australian? Because that is the most Australian name I've ever heard on anybody.
Shailene?
Yeah.
Shailene.
Shailene Woodley. She should be Australian. I think that a campaign should be started to make her Australian, because then all will be right with the world. Anything else you want to say about The Fault in Our Stars?
No,
this is precisely the moment.
Won't be a sequel.
Well, don't speak too soon. This is precisely the moment that we would normally say, hey, in 2 words, and lock it off, but we don't. So we will do. We will have something else next episode, no doubt. Time to look at a New Zealand entry into our cinemas.
You're lucky there's glass here. I'd smash you.
Oh, pretty tough behind your window, eh, white girl?
Hey, Rog. Me and Pete go away for a couple of weeks. You look after Mum? Gonna go find our dad.
Why do you want to be a Mary?
What's your culture?
Don't have one. Free running, maybe.
I just wanted to point out that that trailer, 1 minute 40 seconds, has almost no dialogue in it whatsoever. So extremely difficult to pluck some audio for our show. Anyway, if you want to find out more about Fantail, the production of it, I think the original Cinematica episode from the film festival last year is still available online. So what we'll do is we'll stick a link to it in the show notes, such as they are, when we finally post the show. So if you have a look, if you go to the website, which we'll tell you all about a little bit later on, then you'll be able to hear from the filmmakers, Curtis Vowell.
Sophie Henderson.
Sophie Henderson, thank you very much. Sophie Henderson, whose film it is, really, frankly, she wrote it, and etc.
And they're such a lovely couple.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
So nice
it was
interviewing them.
It was a lovely interview, and I'm so glad that this is a film that is actually making it into cinemas. You know, because you know, for a little indie film like this, very hard to break through. Darren, have you seen Fantail?
Yeah, I didn't catch it at the festival last year, so I saw it when it was screened again just ahead of its release. And I have to say, the screen a couple of days after, there was another screening that when it opened to the public, and I have to really give real props to Sophie and Curtis. I'm on first name terms with them, obviously, but they were up there mingling in the Rialto and Newmarket, hanging around for a Q&A for the people who'd gone to see it afterwards. They're clearly passionate about this, which sounds like a stupid thing to say because it's their film, but they really care. They seem to really care about it, and I just thought that was great. They were just milling around. There was no airs and graces. I don't know whether it's a New Zealand thing or just a local thing, but they just didn't seem to mind being there and seemed to love everyone coming up and talking to them before the film, and I'm assuming probably afterwards as well. So there's a real kind of buzz building to it, and I know that I was quite devastated when I missed this at the festival last year, because a couple of people have been saying how great it was, and that buzz has slowly built and grown throughout the year.
So what do you think of the strengths of a film like Fantail? It seems to me that that it's got a similar problem to the other two films that we've talked about today, in that it has a really great setup and goes a long way to reaching a conclusion, then doesn't really know how to end. And so I was kind of dissatisfied with the ending. It kind of seemed over dramatized compared to the setup of it. But the strengths are the production design and particularly the acting. I thought that it really is an actor's movie, isn't it?
Yeah, I have to fully agree with you at the end. I really wasn't on board with the ending, and I just, when it came out from that side, I felt like I'd really been slapped across the face a little bit, because it just seemed to come completely out of the bolt of the blue, and I didn't really feel like it made a lot of sense. I know that this is this film has come from a monologue that Sophie Henderson had written years back, I think back in 2005. There's a great interview with her on the Lumiere Reader website, which is worth seeking out, where she talks about it. So she's been with it for years, and I would be really intrigued and interested to know how the actual monologue ended, because the way the film ends seems at odds from the rest of it. But like you, I thought the strength of it was that it felt New Zealand in some ways, but it also felt universal in others. I mean, there's a lot of talk about self-identity and whether this character clearly wants to be Maori, and pronunciations and the way she's talking, there's an element of that. But I mean, she's just very, very watchable, and the character that she's built and the life that she's built around her on screen makes it feel like it could be anywhere. Sure, it's set in South Auckland, and there are parts of that with the Bay of Plenty, with the brother going out to work on the kiwi farm, kiwi plantation. But it just feels universal in some of the areas that it covers. I mean, we've all done crap jobs like that and got through the night and various bits and bobs. So there's a kind of universality that I really think gives this one of its strength, and yeah, it's also the performances as well.
Yeah, and this is a film that's actually done really well internationally at festivals, and I think that universality that you talk about is why, you know, audiences responded to it really well at Melbourne last year, and I know that it's gone into markets internationally, and I think everybody involved with it's very likely to have a reputation enhanced, and it's not playing at terribly many places. It is one of those that audiences are going to have to seek out. And let's hope that if you do miss it on the big screen, it's going to show up on, I hope, on the New Zealand Film Commission's streaming site, where you can rent movies to watch at home. You don't have to go through iTunes. You can you'll be paying your money to the New Zealand Film Commission, which means that, you know, the money's going to go back into the New Zealand film industry. So it's If you do miss something like Fantail at the movies, the Film Commission site might well be the best way to go about watching it. And if you go to that site, their streaming site, you'll see that there are a lot of films there that aren't available on DVD, or if they were, they're not anymore. So a chance to really catch up on a lot of missing stuff through that New Zealand Film Commission streaming site. It's going to get better and better and better. So
it's nice as well that it's through the Escalator scheme, which is theirs, isn't it? So it's nice that it's coming back to them as well. It seems very cyclical on that kind of front.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, and that, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for this week. Well, next week, I'm sure there will be a show. I haven't actually thought much beyond tonight being honest. And, you know, after waking up to the news from Iraq this morning, let's just hope that there is a next week, shall we? Probably the worst news that you could have heard. If you have enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe to the show at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious, or rather you can go to that address, funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious, and there you will find a way to communicate with us, either via email, or you can make a comment on the site. That's a pretty old-fashioned way of doing things, isn't it? But you know, the opportunity will be there. We haven't submitted to iTunes yet because until tonight we haven't had anything to submit to iTunes. And I think we've probably got to have 2 or 3 episodes in the can before we really go to town with the whole iTunes thing. Rest assured, we will let you know as soon as we possibly can. Mm. All the different ways there's going to be. We might even have an Android app. You never know.
Oh, just for me.
Exactly. So there's lots of different ways in which people are going to be able to listen to the show. How are people going to be able to interact with us?
You can follow us on Twitter at Rancho Podcast, which we'll be setting up tonight. Getting ready.
Yeah, we're just waiting for the final draft of the logo to come through morning. Yeah, so seriously, I signed off on the design this afternoon. This is how tight to deadline this whole project has been.
This is how passionate we are. Yeah. We're just all sails to the wind. I keep punching this microphone.
Okay, I'll redesign that. Cool.
You can follow us on Twitter at Rancho Podcast.
With no punctuation.
No punctuation.
Capital R, capital P.
Rancho Podcast. Okay.
Yeah.
We'll be tweeting incessantly about things we think are interesting. And in the fullness of time, you'll be able to find us on Letterboxd too, because we love Letterboxd.
We
and
do.
All the fantastic work they do.
Indeed. This show is a Funerals and Snakes production. Season 1 has been executive produced by Robert Catto, Random Films, Claire Quiray, Mark Cuby, Anthony S. Pratt. What, that's an executive producer name if ever I've seen one. Anthony S. Pratt, Fred Thompson. We're looking forward to getting your reviews, Fred. Matthew Buchanan.
From Letterboxd.
Yeah, the theme music, the start of the show, is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly by Los Plantronics. You can buy that at the iTunes store, and we're going to play out with some more music. If you are one of those people who has seen The Fault in Our Stars, you will be no doubt disappointed at the relatively small amount of Swedish hip-hop featured in the film. We have found some more for you. This is, in fact, the full version of the song that was so quickly cut down. A fussy, och filthy, and boom falarala. Apparently, if you speak Swedish, this means that we should have an explicit icon in iTunes. Maybe that's another reason for cutting it. It was cut out early in the film. Thanks very much to Darren for being our inaugural guest host. Darren, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, lovely. And I'd just like to say to the studio executives who are looking at the casting of the show, I accept your decision to recast me next week.
Excellent.
Well, I think it's going to be a rotating guest host hot seat for a while. So don't you worry. The call will come out sooner rather than later. So thank you very much. And that is it for this particular show, the first show, the pilot. Breathless. That is good night from me, Dan Slevin.
Good night from me, Kaylee Carruthers.
Står du vid min väg, betala vänligen trängselavgift, oavsett om du är moderat eller vänsterpartist. För vi lever i en visslande tid som svischar förbi, där jag gror i mitten och allt annat vissnar bredvid. Det blir väl, bort utom bensin, tjuppe, slut på de bensin. Richard ville boom, 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 explodera som. Måtte du hinna stånga mig, så kom igen och ge mig en motstånd innan du ångrar dig. Biter av stora kroppspulsådern som transporterar syre åt hela jävla världens docusåper. Det är trist att jobba, så jag sitter och joddlar och groggar vodka med diskmedel och fiskleverolja. Rätt vad det går i dåligt.